Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to increase major planned and principal giving. QBAC acts as a force multiplier for fundraisers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with prospects and cultivating them into lifelong donors. QBAC automates the qualification process beyond simple scoring to ensure that your fundraisers have the best prospects. QBAC also uncovers actionable insights about current and future prospects to help fundraisers develop personalized cultivation strategies. Start closing bigger gifts in less time by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. Also, how about being our next host for the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow? I'm looking forward to two things this summer: getting back to the ballpark with my kids and getting the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow back on the calendar. If your organization would like to be a host location, let's schedule a time to chat. The Responsive Fundraising Roadshow provides 6 hours of the best fundraising training out there based on Responsive's 4 sense-making tools. Hosting Responsive's Roadshow is not like hosting a major conference that requires months of planning and all types of resources. All we need you to do is provide us with a safe learning environment for 25 adult professionals in your community who want to understand how highly effective fundraising really works. There is no cost to your organization, and we will reimburse you for all related expenses. If your organization would like to host the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow in your community, reach out and let's have a conversation today. Hi, Kevin. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. You and I have been going back and forth trying to get this on the schedule. I think we've got lots of mutual friends. I know in the Salvation Army world, we probably have more mutual friends than we probably know about. And maybe after this broadcast, we'll figure out if we have a few more friends. I have been very eager to get you on here, and we have finally managed to coordinate our schedules. I think I messed something up last week, so I appreciate you being flexible with me, but we've got you on here, Kevin. And first thing, let's just ask you to introduce yourself to our listeners.
Yes, my name is Kevin Feldman, and I am Director of Development with the Salvation Army in the Chicago metro region. And I am actually based in Northwest Indiana, which is part of the Chicago metro region. And I've been involved in fundraising now, leading development programs for 33 years.
So, Kevin, have you been raising money at the Salvation Army for 33 years? Is that have you been raising money elsewhere as well? I mean, that's remarkable. Time period, but has it been all at the Army?
Hardly. No. Like many, I've lived through many turnovers in development director jobs and development positions, and it's kind of common in the industry, as you know.
Yes. So, but. I'm a big fan. When I first got into this work, I was working with a lot of nonprofit. I was working for parachurch organizations, and I remember going, and you may have been at some of these conferences as well, Kevin. Mm-hmm. One of the first conferences I went to was a Christian Stewardship Association conference. They were doing them mostly. They were based out of Indianapolis. The organization sort of gone defunct and merged with the Management Association. But at the time, that organization had formed a very strong affinity and friendship with the Army. And there was a book that had come out. I'm sure the book is probably within arm's reach of where you're seated, just about how extraordinary of an organization that the Army has been, and the impact that it makes, sort of what it does both as a mission, as an organization, you know, delivering on what it's supposed to do, but also organizationally speaking. I remember very early in my career reading that particular book. You're familiar with the book that I'm talking about?
I am not, Jason. I'm sorry to say, but the Salvation Army does have a very unique history, 160 years old, approximately, yes. Founded by General William Booth and in England. And its beginnings were very interesting and unique. And today it is a very wonderful organization to serve. And very unique in many ways, and it operates in very unique ways as well, different from many other organizations.
Yeah, and I have worked with a number of fundraisers who work in the Army space. Mm-hmm. So, Kevin, we invite our guests to come on the podcast with a big idea or bold opinion. We don't ask you necessarily to disclose what that big idea or bold opinion is with me. Generally, it makes for a much more natural conversation when you just come in with an idea or an opinion and we just unravel it. So what mm-hmm. do you got for us today?
The nonprofit space often treats its major donors with high esteem, given much attention. The majority of a development person's time, a gift officer's time, is spent with so-called major donors based on the donor's giving history. And I'm here to say that all donors should be treated like major donors, and I have some very good reasons for that opinion.
Yeah, so I have to imagine that I probably agree with you, but I try to withhold my opportunities to hop up on my own soapbox for at least 10 or 15 minutes. So how about we get you to unpack that? I have a guess where you're going.
Yep.
Tell us where you're going with that.
Sure. I have a strange hobby, Jason. I collect stories of common everyday individuals, unknown individuals that were very quiet about their wealth, very quiet about their earnings and investings and savings, lived very humbly. And when passing away, left hundreds of thousands, millions and millions of dollars to their favorite charities. And these people were not on the radar of any charities until they passed away. And it's sad. It's sad that these folks had a passion for these organizations, these causes. Nobody noticed. Nobody appreciated them. Until after they left this earth, you know, and one such person, which I wrote about on LinkedIn many years ago, was a gentleman named Albert Lexie. You may be familiar with that story. Albert was had a shoeshine stand on the streets of downtown Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, for many years, and Albert had a hobby of playing the stock market. So what he decided to do many years before his death was he decided that he would take the tips, he would live off the earnings of his shoeshine business, what he charged for his shoeshines, and he would take the tips and he would invest them in the stock market. Well, Albert Lexie died in 2018, and in 2018, to everyone's surprise, Albert Lexie had made a bequest of $202,000 to the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center's Children's Hospital, and it was all the tips he collected and invested in the stock market over the years, and I've got literally hundreds of stories like that, some of them much bigger gifts and equally as amazing.
You know, there's a lot of people, Kevin, there's a lot of people sort of in our fundraising space right now talking about sort of this underlying, I've said it a number of times, I've described it this way, there seems to be some underlying angst. And this angst even tends to be similar as I think about the people I've talked to, it tends to be people who've perhaps been in the field for perhaps 10, 15, 20 years. I've been in the space for 20 plus years. You've been in a little longer. There's some angst about sort of where fundraising sort of finds itself. And it tends to, some of this angst tends to be expressed in ways that you've sort of just kicked off our conversation with. And I kind of wonder, Kevin, if the challenge is not so much the difference between the big donors and the little donors, and whether it's actually between the generous and the non-generous. And what I mean by that is I've been reading, as I've been researching my forthcoming book, I've been reading the generosity science studies that went on at Notre Dame. I think they started in 2014. They basically came to the conclusion that only about a third to maybe a half of the population, of any slice of our population, really has the underlying inclination to be generous. And so I wonder, Kevin, if part of maybe in between the lines of what you're saying is that we should be focusing on people who are generous, less inclined to focus on the size of the gift, and should we just be trying to discern whether you're a generous person or not? Does that make sense?
Oh, it does. And Jason, you've been where I'm about to go right now, where you work for a director of development or a nonprofit CEO who sees that when Bill Gates first came on the scene, right? You know, I mean, I remember those days, right? When Bill Gates came on the scene, you know, and everybody saying, you know, we really need to write to Bill Gates and ask him for money. You know, he's some of the new rich, the new wealthy that are out there, right? And there's that tendency to do that, and the CEO, wrongfully, or the development director, depending on the experience they have, wrongfully thinks that that's a good use of the gift officer's time, is to go after the people that are best known for being wealthy and the best known for giving away their money. What they don't realize is that there are thousands and thousands of nonprofits and their leaders who think that way, and board members who think that way. So you're Bill Gates, right? And all of your other wealthy people, old and new, right, are getting hit up for donations tens of hundreds of times more than the average person. So your likelihood of getting a donation from them, particularly a major gift, is much smaller. So where are you going to spend your time, right? Where you're more likely to get a gift, and actually with your average donor, with your mid-level, even your low-level donor, you're far more likely to get a gift. With a volunteer who works for you, serves your organization, you're more likely to get a gift than somebody who has a lot of money. And even though that gift might be smaller, collectively, if you look at the numbers of those smaller donors, right, you're talking about a lot of money that's on the table that's for the taking of nonprofit organizations if they treat those donors in a more professional, personal, and appreciative manner.
Like I shared with you, I think before we hit the record button, I first half of my fundraising career was all in the faith-based space, parachurch organizations. And I was in the discussions about sort of the, whether or not we should show, you know, favor and preference to the larger donors and so forth and so forth. And there's plenty of arguments out there. And certainly when we're talking about fundraising in a biblical context, we're not generally going to say that you should be showing favor towards the super affluent, wealthy sort of people. And, you know, we want to acknowledge the widow's mite and so forth and so forth. But I think when we focus on generosity is, and it's not something that you can put in them, you can't, you know, there's no database that whereas we can sort of wealth screen people and find out how much wealth they have, we can't necessarily go into a database and find predictive tools necessarily that tell us how generously inclined they are, regardless of what their level of wealth is. But is part of the flaw about fundraising practices? My critique tends to be that the fundraising practices that we most engage in don't allow us to discern who those most generous of people are. So if you're saying, okay, let's disregard the size of the checks and let's focus on the generous of the not the generous versus the non-generous, but you're relying almost exclusively, say, for example, on direct mail, you never have a way to ultimately make that discernment to your advantage or even to theirs, to have that meaningful conversation, because you're literally relying on such a shallow form of communication. You follow what I'm saying?
I follow what you're saying 110%, Jason. Yes. And you're absolutely right. I mean, that's the challenge. I mean, as development people, we're always operating under the tyranny of the urgent. There's always deadlines for direct mail. There's golf outings and events that you have deadlines for. Right. There's and the small development shops are stretched even further. Let me tell you though of just an experience that I had 20 years ago. It's 20 years ago. I was working for one of these large international parachurch organizations, and literally this organization had at the time about 200,000 donors in its database. I mean, it was a huge organization. Many of them small, but the organization in its marketing, both television broadcast marketing and its direct mail, pushed monthly donations of $20 to $40 per donor. Right. And I was directing foundation, corporate and foundation relations at the time. And I was trying to look for a kind of an inroads to finding out who's connected in our database with corporations and foundations that we need to get to know. And so I convinced management that we need to invest in, and you mentioned it, wealth screening, a wealth screening program. And so I shopped around and we found something that we felt would work. And so we literally took our database and ran our active donors and ran it through wealth screening. And myself and a couple of other people that worked for me, we went through this data. And we uncovered hundreds, literally hundreds of people verifiably who were trustees of foundations that we've been trying to get money from, that were executives with corporations that we were trying to get money from, that had been giving to this nonprofit ministry for many years at the low level. Why were they giving at this ministry at a low level? Because that's all they were ever asked to give, and they were acquired from this $20 to $40 a month ask, and there's where they stayed because the ministry made the mistake of having this way of judging who's a major donor based on the amount of their gift, right? So at the time, anybody who made a gift of $500, a single gift of $500 or more, would be put in a major gift category, would be called upon by a major gift officer and followed up with. If you made $20 or $40 a month gifts, you would just stay in the direct mail stream forever and ever until you made a gift that size and reached that threshold. And so there, those people stayed for a long, long time. And so I took it at the next step further. After doing that research and creating a report, I presented a proposal to the senior management of this organization and said, look, we need to invest in some more automated process that is screening people as they're giving, as they're making these donations, whether they're new donors or old donors or whatever, and they're screening them and identifying them as potential people connected with foundations, corporations, or connected in a way where it says that these people have the investments and the income to make larger gifts, so that rather than depending on them reaching a $500 threshold before they're being contacted by a gift officer, we're being proactive and we're identifying them as a prospect for a major gift. And we're giving that information then to a gift officer that's in their region of the country, who then follows up with them to cultivate that relationship and eventually ask them to make a gift that's at or over that $500 threshold, so that they now are officially major donors, right? So, and it was amazing, and it really revolutionized fundraising for that particular organization, so much so that within two years, they went from having 14 major gift officers around the country to 40 major gift officers around the country, because they had so many more prospects to work with. And those prospects were being cultivated and more larger gifts were coming in.
Okay. So, but is part of the, so go back to your $20 to $40 gift.
Right.
Okay. I work with a lot of institutions that, private schools. I work with a lot of private schools, and a lot of the private schools that I work with are absolutely convinced that the typical family that they're serving is stretched. They're financially stretched, and being able to pay tuitions requiring that they take second mortgages out on their homes and da 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 da. Basically, I have to convince these clients, for example, that their constituents, their donors, or their families in this case, are not broke. And I think that's one of the things that the nonprofit sector, perhaps because we're so oriented towards the downtrodden, the marginalized, people who are truly broke, we oftentimes sort of project this assumption onto our donors, which when you think back on the story you just told, your organization was asking for $20 and $40 gifts. And in many cases, those were the gifts that those people could accurately give. But was there an underlying assumption that $20 to $40 was what people could give, and that they had to in some way or another be convinced that no, these people are far more influential, far more affluent, and far more capable of giving at much more significant levels. And the systems that we have in place now aren't going to necessarily tell you that. And the way that we go about our work isn't going to tell you that. I think there's organizations that are just plagued around this country and around the globe, plagued with programs of the sort that your group, the group that they initially had, they're just darn convinced, because all they see is these $20 to $40 gifts, that's accurately representative of what their people are capable of. And as you guys found out very quickly, it wasn't accurate at all.
Yeah, I think there's two assumptions. One assumption is that generous people will give more if they're asked for $20 or $40, they'll give more. And if they like what you do, The other assumption is that a success, and this is an assumption really on the management side of things, is that the fundraising, when it comes to fundraising, acquiring new donors, the more donors you acquire, the more successful you are, right? I think a lot of nonprofits get on this roller coaster of acquisition. Oh, we have to acquire new. Oh, look at all the donors we acquired, and they ignore. And man, I've seen it. I know you've seen it. They ignore how many donors are lapsing, how many donors are leaving giving to the organization altogether, and they figure if they can just keep acquiring a lot of donors, it really doesn't matter how many donors lapse. And frankly, this is where this international ministry was 20 years ago in their thinking. They acquired so many donors on a daily basis, so many new donors internationally on a daily basis, they weren't too concerned about lapsing donors. And they already had a lot of significant major donors as well. And so they thought they were sitting pretty comfortably. But even though they were sitting pretty comfortably, the pressure was always on development to raise more money and acquire more donors, right? And those tend to be, from my experience, two very dangerous assumptions that I think nonprofits make about their donors.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Exactly. And so you see these reports that come out every year, just like I do. We see the same reports, and it's this renewal. You know, it's the renewal rates, right?
Right.
And every time I see it, but then for me to go back to what I was saying about the Notre Dame study about generosity, if we assume that 50% of that, so that organization, for example, you were talking about, had 200,000 names in it. If you assume if we draw the assumption that list, for example, was acquired in overly aggressive acquisition sort of methods with very low expectations of what those donors, you know, you accumulated probably a lot of people who were not inclined to renew and were perhaps not very generous people. And so if you look at that list and you just said, okay, 50% of these people aren't going to renew anyway because they just don't fit the profile, the type of people who are going to sort of, they're not generous and they don't want to really do this. They're just sort of responding to sort of that warm glow, momentary sense of changing the world or whatever. And they weren't necessarily probably the people that popped up on your well screening data either, you know, when you started using that particular tool. And I just wonder if we're sort of feeding this information into the minds of fundraising professionals. You and I have been around a while, and so we sort of can use our critical thinking cap here and look at this. But I think about, you know, the fundraiser who's been around for just to say a couple of months or a couple of years, who's looking at this acquisition program, perhaps the same way you and I did very early in our career. And this acquisition program is oftentimes sold on the notion that it's supposed to solve the renewal, the lapsed donor problem, when in fact, neither of those really solve the problem at all. I mean, isn't that basically what we're saying?
It is. And you know, just to use a recent example, though, and you had mentioned it, you know, and here we go again, people making assumptions that, they look at the well screening data and they look at the database and they assume that a lot of these donors aren't generous donors. Well, just a month ago, I'm at my desk and I have kind of a rule around here where I tell people, I say, you know, if any donor that walks in a check, and we do have some that literally insist on driving here and walking in a check to us, I no matter what size, come and get me if I'm here and I want to thank them and find out why they give, right?
Yeah.
And this story is not unusual to the Salvation Army, right? The Salvation Army has stories. Again, I could tell you many stories like this one,
right.
but one of the employees here came up to me and handed me a check for $1,000 and said, "This lady's at the door." And I told her to hold on because you'd like to thank her. So I go down and I meet this lady, and this lady is I think in her 70s. She wasn't in the best of health. She was dressed very casually, and I thanked her for a generous gift. And I asked her, like I ask all the donors, I said, what prompted you to make this gift today? You know, and right. she said, Kevin, your organization has helped me as recently as a month ago. You know, she goes, I've been using your food pantry, you know, through raising our children. My husband who passed away recently was a very hard worker, and he supported us. But there were many times when he was laid off where we needed assistance, and we came to the Salvation Army to get assistance, and we did this as recently as a month ago. My husband unfortunately caught the COVID-19 virus. He was really in good health for his age, so much so that he recently, just before he passed away, and you know, he bought a pickup truck, a good used pickup truck that he'd been wanting, and so he suddenly got sick with COVID-19, passed away. And I sold our 4-bedroom house in Munster, Indiana, moved to Hammond, Indiana, to a one bedroom apartment where I can live. My kids are all grown up now, and it's much cheaper for me to live. But this is my opportunity to give back. I wanted to give you this $1,000 because I had to sell my husband's pickup truck. And this is some money from the sale of the pickup truck, right? So how many stories are like that out there? We're just people. It goes beyond generosity. I mean, if your organization is doing great work, and even if it's a humanitarian organization like the Salvation Army, or it's an organization, that is a pet rescue where you bought your favorite dog or cat, you know, where you picked up your favorite dog or cat, and that was a loving animal, a cherished member of the family for many years. Whatever that may be, how many people are so appreciative of what you do with your organization that they're wanting to show their appreciation monetarily like that. They want to give back, you know, and I dare say, based on my experience too, that there's lots of those people. There's lots of those people that have to express themselves, that you were there when they needed them. You gave them something very meaningful, like a loving dog that your family enjoyed a relationship with for 12 or 13 years, and now it's time for me to show my appreciation to you.
Okay, so again, we're talking about statistics. We're talking about assumptions that are made. One of the things that I have figured, so I get the benefit. This conversation will probably air. We're creeping up on 300 of these conversations. And Kevin, if I have figured out anything, we're often talking about renewal rates, lapsed rates. We're talking about donor attrition. We're inevitably, the conversation gets to this conversation of professional turnover. And what I'm so, if you want to hear what sort of gets me angst up, if you want to, It's this idea that that this in some way has to do with the donor, or it has something to do with the fundraiser. And what I know it all has to do with is we've got to be creating more environments It's all about the management and the board and the environment we create for these people to basically experience on either side of the gift exactly what you just described. And I am absolutely convinced that if we will create more scenario, I don't care how big the gift is. I don't really care. I don't care if it's small, big, somewhere in the middle, millions or hundreds or whatever. But we don't have enough fundraisers and we don't have enough donors having these sort of serendipitous collisions, as you just basically described, to sort of experience the both generosity and gratitude on both sides. She was expressing gratitude and generosity in one motion, and you essentially were doing the same thing. You were both experiencing both sides of what it means to exchange something generously, because you were both experiencing gratitude at the same time. I mean, isn't that essential? I'm a baseball guy. I'm wearing a baseball cap. Mm-hmm. We're going to be going to a baseball game tonight. Who wants to go to a baseball game when you're in a lousy ballpark, right? It doesn't matter if you've got Babe Ruth home run hitters on the field and you've got a great team. If you're sitting in a lousy ballpark, who wants to be there? And I think that's the critique that we've got to start owning up to as nonprofit organizations, that we're just not creating beautiful places for donors and fundraisers to exchange these gifts like you just described.
Well, you're right. And I think that environment goes beyond a nice ballpark or a nice building sure. to gather in. I think it's the attitude and the mindset that if you treat all donors like major donors, right? Then you're going to hit more home runs, right? To use a baseball terminology, because there's a lot of people like this lady that I mentioned. There's a lot of people who equally appreciate what an organization might have done for them and their families, who just don't take the initiative, or maybe they're disabled and can't get out to really thank you, right? You know, like they want to, or maybe there's just somebody who, like Albert Lexie, the Pittsburgh shoe shiner, who really likes what you do, right? And is secretly just kind of saving for that right moment. He doesn't need to be acknowledged, you know, all the time. If he were acknowledged, you know, if he were shown appreciation just for the small gifts that he was given, maybe he might have left more, or maybe he would have appreciated your organization and its work more. But the fact is, there's people out there that we'll never know about, that are generous, that give sacrificially, those that are wealthy and are very private about it, that never hit the wealth screening radar, that you'll never know about. And the only way to be able to capture gifts from those people is to adopt that mindset to treat all donors like major donors. And there's not one method of doing that. It's all about what your systems are, in your nonprofit organization. Some are very dependent on direct mail. Some have major gift officers. Some don't. But with whatever time you have, the more you can pick up the telephone and just thank a donor for their gift, whether it's $20, $40, or $1,000, that's a huge step in that direction. And I'll tell you, there are very few nonprofits that do that. There's very few nonprofits that will just go down the day's gifts that have come in the door and say, okay, here's a list. Everybody just call these donors and just thank them for their gift, you know, and pray with them, you know, ask them why they support the nonprofit. You don't have to spend a lot of time on the phone with them, but that telephone call, that personal touch will make a huge difference and make them feel appreciated and make them feel like their gift means more to you than maybe they even thought while making it.
Is some of this, okay, so I at the very beginning of my career, you've got to remember when this came out. So you remember this was right around the turn of the century, right before, probably around the time of September 11th, and everything sort of was happening in the late night. I bet the first book. So the guy wrote the book. I can't think of his name, but he wrote the Millionaire Mind and the Millionaire Next Door. And those were books that guys like you and I were basically told to read early in our fundraising careers, because it sort of gave us this perspective that the donor who's wearing the, you know, the flashy clothes and the, you know, the expensive wristwatch and driving up in the, you know, fancy car isn't necessarily the millionaire, whereas the person who is the millionaire is showing up with, you know, a Timex watch and a much less recently manufactured car and perhaps doesn't live in the most extraordinary home. And I kind of wonder if some of us sort of early in our career, when we're reading something like The Millionaire Next Door, sort of missed the, maybe some of us interpreted what was supposed to be learned from that. Some of us learned sort of an exploitive, how do we find out if they are in fact rich? And others of us, and I think this is true for myself, and it sounds like it's true for you, rather than sort of seeing this as an exploitive, how do we find out if this person's truly rich, we saw this as an exploratory sort of learning lesson that you're going to have to explore relationships, and you don't necessarily have to rely on these predictive tools to necessarily answer all these questions. You just basically have high expectations for yourself, similarly have a high expectations for your donors. And a lot of times over time, these things emerge in conversation. I mean, that's always been the most enlightening, most enjoyable part of my work is when learning about the extraordinary opportunity that a donor represents, not because some well screening data told me, but because I went out and sort of pursued it like an explorer with all sincerity and genuineness, desiring to build a meaningful relationship. And it very serendipitously sort of came back and benefited my employer. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, it does. It does. And I remember those. I remember those days. Those days were also the days when we were being told, and it was being drummed into our heads, that there was this great wealth transfer that was going to happen, and we've got to get on board with this. And people are going to make, you know, there's planned gift, legacy gift opportunities that are just waiting to happen, right? You know, and everybody was quick to jump on board of that, which is good, because there really is and was then a great wealth transfer. The problem is that the relationships with donors didn't change. The people transferring wealth weren't always the rich people, right? There were people like Albert Lexie. There were people like a lot of other folks who early in their careers started investing or making a planned gift, right? People that never married or couples who never had children who made a planned gift to their favorite nonprofit or nonprofits, right? And so throughout their careers, throughout their lives, more and more money go into that fund, and when they pass away, these folks who live their lives humbly, and maybe he or she was a blue collar worker, she might have been a teacher or something like that, have amassed a fortune. I've got examples of public school teachers. I mean, there's a lot of them, public school teachers, who donate millions and millions of dollars in with a planned gift to their favorite charities. And they were public school teachers, you know, but the thing is, with that great wealth transfer, you know, nobody ever thought, or I shouldn't say nobody, but most of us at that time never thought, well, these could very well be people that are middle income, you know, middle income people, blue collar workers, you know, teachers. You know, we were thinking again, like we thought when we were young, these are rich people, you know. So the wealth transfer is going to be something that the rich do, not just the average mom and pop, right?
Okay, so this will be the last question. We lose our listeners at about 45 minutes. So I got to get your thoughts on this. You've been doing this long enough. You've been doing this a little longer than I have. So, is one of the things that we're the most guilty of in not, I oftentimes say, Kevin, here on the podcast, that the fundraising profession's and it's still in its messy adolescence. So we just haven't collectively grown up yet. Then is part of the problem, because a lot of what you think about what we've centered on here for the last 40 minutes is that we've sort of majored on the technical aspects of this, the technical aspects that are oftentimes designed to sort of exploit what is known rather than sort of lean into the relational and more exploratory aspects of this that are not known, that they're not certain, but those are also the things that are life-giving to both the person on your side and the person on the, you know, the giving and receiving side of these things. Are we guilty of sort of making this too technical of work?
I think so. I think we want to make our jobs easier, right? We want to reach more people faster and have more and get more gifts faster. And so the more mechanized you can make it, the more automated you can make it, the better is the thinking, right? And I think there's validity to that thinking, but that's why development shops need to be larger, right? The one person development shop can't be interpersonal and relational and be fully mechanized all at the same time. You know, you really have to have relationships take time. So you have to have people who have time to make the phone calls, to write the letters, and go out and meet people, and you also have to have the staff who can manage databases and handle direct mail and do this kind of thing and that kind of thing. For a small nonprofit, it may only take two people, but the thing is, most nonprofits only have one fundraising person. You know what I mean? So I think that's where we are today for the most part. And you're right. I like the term you use that we haven't quite grown up. You know, we're still kind of in our infancy, you know, with fundraising. And I hope we don't always stay there. I would like to grow up before I die. Right. You know,
yeah. That's why I enjoy these conversations with people who've been around a little bit longer than I have. Like I said earlier, I think there's angst in the space, and I think there's been some turning moment. You know, if you think about the way that fundraising has played out, especially over the last two decades, with the starting with September 11th and then with the recession and now with COVID-19, you talk about three very unpredictable events that have kind of just thrown us all up, you know, tossed us all around, and really even challenged some of this. Some of this technical predictive sort of stuff that we think makes our job easier. In those sorts of times, those were the times where you really needed to count on high context relationships, the ability to engage even in simple ways like you and I are doing today.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, we've got to wrap up, but if somebody has listened to our conversation today and they're like, I want to reach out to that guy, Kevin, and start a conversation, how would you suggest that they do that?
I think the best way is to just email me at the Salvation Army, Kevin, K-E-V-I-N dot Feldman, F-E-L-D-M-A-N, at USC.SalvationArmy.org.
Kevin, it has certainly been a pleasure. You are always welcome back. Thank you for being my guest today.
Well, thank you, Jason. It's been a pleasure being on.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all-too-familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.